Hello, hello. Welcome back to the Life Without Limits podcast. I am Yogi Roth, and thanks for joining in. Not only listening to this podcast, which I think is it's going to be so much different than anyone we've had, but also, first and foremost, for listening to the other podcasts and leaving notes on our social media platform, emails, notes, obviously reviews on iTunes are huge. But I think we've built this really cool community that is digging into seeking what it means to be human. And I know like that sentence is kind of weird, you know, what does it mean to be human? But I think at the end of the day, we all want to live a full life. We want to live a life where we get to pen the script and one where when it's all over, we don't have any regrets. And I think it's interesting because as a child, it's really easy to live that way, right? If we have children, if we have nieces or nephews, and we see them carefree, going for it, charging, not worried about consequences. And as we get older, we become fear-based at times, and we don't remember the idea of what it means to have a childlike fascination, what it means to be human, what it means to go and charge. And today's guest is somebody who has charged in all realms of life. Curious if he's even recognized and looking forward to his opinion. His name's Joey Roberts. He's 27 years old. He would say he's going on 47, but he's a fascinating young man. You're going to love his story. Grew up in Southern California, athletic community, goals, dreams, aspirations, like anyone does who grows up in this culture of sport, athletics, competition, and took a jump in college to go to school near the ESPN campus in Connecticut and has skyrocketed in his career. His path will be one full of anecdotes, full of great stories as he's been around Hall of Famers, rock star broadcasters, people that have influenced my life a lot, like guys like Trent Dilfer, and there's also people that have influenced his life that we'll get into their story. But what I'm most excited about is that Joey Roberts is a guy who has spent his career researching other people's story. And I'm really excited that he's on this path of researching his own. And I think for a lot of us that grind and work and compete, we can relate to that, me included. You're working so hard on a craft, on a job, that you can sometimes forget to work on your own. So let's not wait any more time and bring in good friend Joey Roberts. Joey, welcome to the show, brother.
What's up, Yogs, and arguably your biggest fan, listening to you kick it off with your mom on the podcast and Kevin Carroll, Brett Hughes, and Wordsmith. I mean, I got notes for days. It's been a joy to listen to your stuff, wake up to it, learn from it, and I try to apply it in my life.
Well, thank you very much. That's awesome. So let's level set right off the bat. Where are you right now? And if you were to describe what you do every day, how would you do it? Just to give the listener a picture of a day in Joey Roberts right now.
Currently at the ESPN headquarters in Bristol, Connecticut, overlooking the campus from our new DC2 building, production building, where Sports Center and NFL Countdown and insiders are held and shot and produced and sent out to the world. A typical day starts at, say, 6 in the morning. I sent you a packet, Yogs. It goes through all 32 teams, and every team has a beat writer, two beat writers, or three beat writers, and they have bloggers, and there's just a lot. It's a wealth of information out there for each team and for each player and each coach and each GM. And it's all getting concentrated in the media. And we have to do the best job portraying what is happening today in the NFL world on our NFL shows. So what better way to use the system that's in place, which are the over 150 beat writers across the country, and have them put together in a packet form that our analysts, our anchors, our producers can look through and get to see what's happening with the Cardinals and get to see what's happening with the Washington Redskins and understand what Bill O'Brien's doing in Houston. So I scour the internet. I read a lot. I read every newspaper article for each city and each team. I put it together in a condensed form as almost in a newspaper format for the ultimate goal that if you're Teddy Bruschi or you're Trent Dilfer or Mike Canberra, producer, if you didn't tune into any NFL news the day before, that you'd be caught up for the day of. So that gets me a 2-hour start on the day. Then we go into, we have pre-production meetings for NFL Insiders and NFL Live, basically mapping out the show, how are we going to tell the story of that day, and always being aware that at any point breaking news can happen from an Adam Schefter or a Chris Morrison. After that, intermix, I'll be mixing in some quarterback evaluations for Elite 11. Brian Stumpf, our general manager and head of student sports, he will send out a list of quarterbacks that we'll be seeing every weekend at a different location, whether it's Chicago or Charlotte or Oakland, and each kid has a huddle link, and you got to put an evaluation to them. How do they play on tape? And then we get to dig a little bit, and how are they on and off the field? Are they ultimately trustworthy? And then also mapping out our coaches and 7-on-7 and a bunch of other things, or a bunch of different hats, but that's kind of a glimpse. Hopefully it was a little long-winded, but that's what I do on a day-to-day basis.
All right, so you got a lot of free time, obviously. Wow, what would you call yourself if you had to give – what's your official title? Obviously, you're a producer on a variety of these shows. And if you had to describe yourself, what would you use? Because clearly you've got a lot in your plate.
My official ESPN title is ESPN Associate Sports Scout. There's one of them, and I don't know if there will ever be another one. But that's the title. From my standpoint, I'd love to say I'm a connector. Connect people that would never have met each other, possibly if I was never in the middle. And ultimately, you know, 5 years ago when you and Dr. Gervais spoke to the Elite 11 guys when Trent took it over, and you said, here's an exercise. Can you describe your life's philosophy in 25 words or less? And on the face of it, all the guys are, including myself, I'm like, oh, that's easy. No problem. And you get to the point where you're bouncing around with words and you're bouncing around with different meanings and stuff, and you're like, gosh, this is a lot harder than I thought it would be. And the connector part is, on the back end of my life philosophy, is always competing to help others reach their maximum potential. And at every intersect of my life now and every decision I have to make, is it ultimately leading to that? Can you help others reach their maximum potential? Even if it's just a little step in the right direction, or if it's a nudge, or if it's a complete shove in the right direction, can you do that? So I would say if there's one word to put it to me, I'd say connector.
Wow. So we're going to obviously dive into that, because that's a sentence that's got a lot to unpack. But curious about you growing up. You know, people will see an image of you on this blog post. You grew up in kind of the football mecca of California, but you are not a 6'4", 215-pound quarterback. So for you, what was your childhood like, and where did you get your competitive temperament from?
Not 6'4", and people describe me, and being in the quarterback space, obviously of 6'1" and above, I'm all 5'7", maybe 5'8", if I get on my tippy toes and weigh 160 pounds, depending on if I work out or not. And everyone's kind of taken aback. Like, so this guy knows about quarterbacks, or this guy has a voice in the quarterback community, and I'm perfectly fine with that. And growing up, I'm the youngest of three. Older brother Robbie's 33, sister's 31, Tiffany. And we were so active at such a young age, playing sports from soccer to baseball to basketball. And I'm 4 years younger than my sister, so I was brought along on every trip, every game. Basically grew up on the field, observing and just taking it in. And it ultimately boils down to, like, I was always moving. I was always moving forward. And I was always observing, hey, what does it take for my brother to excel at that level, 6 years above me? What does it look like to be on the varsity team of the Michigan High School Diablo? What does it take for my sister to excel? So constant observation, and that's where competitiveness came from. Not only was I observing, I was measuring myself up to them. Could I compete with them? It's funny you say this, is that when your mom it stuck with me, talked about just like dreaming and fairy tales and how she grew up in an environment that didn't allow her to dream and didn't allow her to have fairy tales. Like, I instantly thought of, in the backyard, our house wasn't the biggest house of them all. It's in Orange County, but it's definitely not what you perceive on MTV's Orange County. There's just a backyard, a little grass patch. And when we were growing up, we had some good friends, Farrows and Malins, Julianos, that we created a wiffle ball field. And basically mimic professional players. We'd have breaks where we had sugary Kool-Aid, and we had Excel sheets for stats on how we did. It was almost like the Sandlot recreated. And that's where, you know, you're not only competing against my brother's friends, but you also have an identity of, like, I can do this. And I can become a professional baseball player. I can become a professional basketball player if I really put my mind to it. And as we grew up, that's the environment that my dad and my mom fostered, was that you take care of the grades, you're able to play sports, and they gave us every opportunity to succeed. And from there, you enter Michigan High School, which you said the football mecca, and it's very close to that. You play for a guy like Bob Johnson, who's has over 300 career wins, Rob Johnson and Fred Johnson's father, and every second is a competition. How you throw away the water bottle is a competition. How do you do everything? It's what you always say, is how you do small things is how you do all things. And it's not even just sports. It was academics. It was everything in between that. Every day at Michigan High School was a competition. So that took me up to basically graduation, where you look around and you have Harvard, you have Stanford, you have 2 years before the Mark Sanchez, you have Division I football players, basketball players, soccer players, and you're really appreciative looking back on it, saying, like, not everyone has that ability to grow up in a competitive environment like that.
Wow, that's pretty neat. So for you, well, your dreams, it seems like as a child, were Major League Baseball, the NBA, some sort of professional sports franchise. As you got older, and whether you recognized that you weren't going to be 6'4", or whatever it would have been, how did your dreams shift? Like, did they become crushed? Did they morph into something else? You know, were you anxious as a child because maybe you weren't becoming the next Carson Palmer or Mark Sanchez?
You know, I was naive. Probably in ninth grade, I thought I was going to be a three-sport varsity stud and score a lot of points in basketball, and catch a lot of passes in football, and hit a home run or two of baseball, and steal some bases. And I ended up lettering in all three sports, and I was backup, second backup, whatever. But I never really gave up on the dream of possibly pursuing playing in college, at least, whether it was a Division III, Division II, Division I, walk-on, whatever it is, that, to your point, I think eventually you start realizing, okay, I'm not going to be Carson Palmer, I'm not going to be Mark Sanchez, but I'm going to get the most out of what I can get. And that was every day coming in and one, just above the neck, knowing everything about what we're doing. So I've never put in a position where, just because physically I'm not gifted, they can say, at least mentally he understands everything, and in a pinch we can put him in. So that's where getting some time in football happened, some time in basketball happened, some time in baseball, just because I was a student of the game. And that's where the whole narrative of Bob Johnson comes in, is just recognizing that and knowing that there was a passion for the game of football that he instilled in me. That it wasn't there before. I grew up as a baseball and basketball fan to my core, even hockey more so than football. And then comes along football, and playing at Michigan High School, to put that in perspective, was my sophomore year. We finished number 2 in the nation, right behind South Lake Carroll, and arguably, you know, those rankings could have been number 1. And then every year that I was there, we were in the top 25 of the nation, competing against the De La Salle of the world, competing against the Long Beach Polys of the world. if you talk about high school football, you're talking about Mission Viejo High School. So being around that and knowing that, it definitely, you saw what the top tier talent looked like. You saw what the Division I left tackle looked like. You saw what the Division I receiver looked like. And I started to realize, okay, maybe it's Division II, or maybe this is my max. And it ultimately ended up being my max, which athletically is perfectly fine for me.
It's interesting because we both, I think growing up in athletically minded cultures, you develop this sense of focus, right? And this sense of goal setting. And no matter what anybody says or does, or how big or small I am, like, I'm going to win, I'm going to achieve, and not even flinch. Both of us, Joey, I'm not sure if you share this, but or know this, but we shared in the dream of desiring to go to Notre Dame, and neither one of us ended up going to South Bend. What is your story about what happened, your love for that place, and really, how did you pivot off of that once you decided you weren't going to go to Notre Dame?
Oh man, Notre Dame is definitely part of my journey, and I'm very thankful for it. Put in perspective, my dad, class of 79, my uncle, class of 71, my sister, class of 2007. So watching Saturdays was Notre Dame. It was Rudy. It was everything. Walking on the campus was perfect. Being a Fighting Irish and all roads, legitimately, when I could even think of college, was all roads led to Notre Dame. I guess looking back on it, maybe all the wrong reasons, that it wasn't maybe truly what I wanted to do, but it's all I knew. So academically, it was checking the boxes on IB and AP courses and what would look good on a resume. It was extracurriculars, playing three sports, lettering in all of them, being an altar boy at our church, doing youth ministry, having a job at It's a Grind Coffee, like, just all the things that if you looked at my resume, I'm like, gosh, it'd be really hard to turn me down Notre Dame. And I remember clear as day, you obviously apply for early admission, and we're actually in Hawaii for a basketball tournament, Not a Bad Life. And you got a call from my dad, and he said, you know what, you didn't get into Notre Dame. And first reaction is hoping that it was actually just deferred. Like, you're deferred, and maybe, like, in the spring admission, you'll get in. It was flat out, you didn't get in. So I'm crushed. I mean, it was like the whole world just falls down, and there's really no hope. It's just all roads led, and all roads just ended up never ending. But anyway, at that time, thinking back on it, a great coach of mine, a mentor, Troy Rowland, was our head basketball coach at the time. Extremely smart, so aware of the ins and outs of life. His initial thing was, okay, what's the action plan? Where do we go from here? Is it University of San Diego, the Catholic School of the West? Is it Boston College, Catholic School on the East Coast? Colorado State? I mean, these are all the college. He just said, you can't dwell on it. I mean, you can't sit there and just feel sorry about yourself. It's over. Notre Dame's done. So it was good to get that feedback within the moment and just to say, all right, what are we going to do now? Fast forward, end up, after a couple applications, end up getting accepted to the University of San Diego. At the time, Jim Harbaugh's there, and Coach Johnson and Jim Harbaugh have a good relationship, and all things being equal, I was going to be ready to walk on there, never play a snap, guaranteed, but be a part of a team, be a part of a competitive culture, and one that he'd won a couple of national championships there. So I'm all set to go. I have my dorm room ready. I'm fired up to be a Torero. I'm an hour away from home, near the beach. Really, things couldn't be better outside of just making Notre Dame. And I get called into Coach Johnson's office, and he goes flat out, do you know who Chris Mortensen is? And I go, Chris Mortensen, like, I know who Chris Berman is, you know, guy on ESPN. And he goes, no, Chris Mortensen, really well-respected journalist. He's on ESPN. He's actually with Boomer on ESPN. And I go, yeah, you know, I just play it off. Like I told you, I grew up a baseball and basketball fan, not so much football. So he goes, well, anyways, Mort is willing to take you under his wing if you can get out to Connecticut. Okay, so instantly, right now, I'd tell my 18-year-old self, jump, go, wherever you need, first flight out, let me know. My instant reaction is like, Connecticut, like, I don't know where that is, and it snows there, and I got this cool deal going down in San Diego. And he basically just smirks at me, like, are you kidding me right now? And luckily, through all the conversations and the visit to Trinity, which was a horrible visit, Trinity College in Hartford, it ended up being that I'm going to go out to Connecticut for a guy that I don't even know the significance of what he brings to this world. And a guy I've never met, and I've only talked to him on the phone once, this guy named Chris Mortensen. I'll be on ESPN's campus, but, like, whatever. Like, you're 18, and I just pass up going to the beach every day and playing for Jim Harbaugh. So I get out there, and I remember it, first production meeting, Saturday, I think it was, like, September 6th. And I get there and meet Mort for the first time, and I walk into that production meeting. And you've been in those production meetings, Yogi, where it's just free-for-all football talk. Unfiltered, you'll hear a cuss word, and you'll hear some people talking about stuff that they'll never talk about on air. But I walk in, and I look to the left, it's Chris Berman. I look to the, right next to him, it's Emmitt Smith. Over in the corner is Keyshawn Johnson. Over to the right, it's Mike Ditka and Tom Jackson. I almost, like, fainted. I mean,
you're 18, right? Like, you're 18 years old.
Yeah, I'm 18 years old. Like, and I actually mustered up the courage to ask Mort, hey, can I take a picture? he like, laughed, and he's like, no, you know what, we'll have plenty of opportunities to take a picture. So sitting on the meeting, and I'm just wide-eyed, bushy-tailed, just loving anything that came out of their mouth. I thought was gospel. It was golden. It was the coolest thing ever. And the dialogue going back was so energetic. And so I go to the first countdown show, and I'm like, gosh, this is live TV. This is what's happening. This is what I grew up watching. And the year goes on, and I do some research projects for more, show up, to this day, you know, did you get his coffee? Like, Mort's such a great guy. Like, it was never like, you're a gopher. So go get my coffee. He always respected me, even at 18. And I look back on the stuff I sent him, and I was laughing about it with him before the draft. You know, it was bad stuff. It was really bad. And I look back, and I'm like, geez, this guy had a lot of patience with me. And Mort's explanation a couple of days ago was, well, it's because a lot of people had patience with me growing up, and a lot of people gave him an opportunity, and it was just paying it forward. And I guess he saw the willingness, and he saw the drive in me, whether I knew fall or not. And then that was a great light in my head to say, hey, you better learn football. If you want to have a voice at this table and you want to contribute, you better learn it. So that started where does it start? The owners. They're making decisions, the team presidents, the GMs, the director of player personnel, the scouts, the head coaches, the offense coordinators, the special teams coordinators, the defense coordinators, the position coaches. Where do they come from? What are they connected by? How do they get there? All the intricacies that I hear come out in more daily nomenclature, the way that the guys talk around the table, and that I was like, I got to learn, and I got to study this thing. So basically, my whole college life was the weekdays earning my degree at Trinity College, and then the weekends learning football. And I would say I double majored in political science and football, and I was learning from the best professors in the world. So within that, you know, that's where the Notre Dame, that's how I got to ESPN, is because Notre Dame said no. And to this day, if I had it all over again, I'd say, yeah, like, my whole heart was in Notre Dame. But it was a blessing in disguise that opened up a door that I never could have imagined. And I'm so deeply passionate about what I do now that it's crazy to think I was going to become a business major at USC and probably be in some corporate office somewhere in New York City and watching football from afar, but not studying it and loving it the way I do.
I think it's interesting, off the top, you talked about how you describe yourself, and your quote was, you want to always compete to help others to maximize their potential. But at that time, it's like you had to always compete to give yourself a chance to tap into your potential and help Mortensen or Mike Ditka, whoever was sitting around the table with you. What's that like when you're 18 to 22 and Thursday nights you should be rolling to the SAE party or just being a college kid? And I'm curious, like, what are you grinding on, like, what it means to play, you know, cover two on third and long, and why teams do that when Tampa 2 is exploding as the new hot defense in the National Football League? I mean, how did you process the, I don't want to call them pressures, but just like the natural evolution of a college kid with the ridiculous evolution that you had going on at ESPN?
Yeah, it was almost like two lives. I mean, it really expanded my work capacity. And that's something I kind of lean in on leading up to something like the draft, where we got Elite 11, we have the draft, we have all these different ventures going. And like, what was it like when it was 19, 20 years old and Trent's having me do a project and Mort's having me do a project? We have this overall production meeting. And then on top of that, you got an essay to write about European politics. And then beyond that, you have some extracurriculars, and you're like, and then, I was the president of my fraternity. So there was a social life that existed inherently in that. And on a side note, my roommate, Matt Sullivan, he started a sports network, a student-run sports network called Trinity Sports Network. And it's the first one ever on the campus, and it's the first one in the New England Small College Athletic Conference, the NESCAC, that Trinity plays in. And I was helping run that, and that was as organic production as you could ever imagine. One camcorder, one tripod, and your iMovie setup on your computer, and just go. And you film games, you film interviews, you just try to recreate what SportsCenter is to glorify the Trinity College athletes that receive no glory. They put in just as much work. There is no NESCAC network like there is the SEC network. There is nothing that existed like that, and it actually built up to a really cool cult, but that was also something that's taken up my time, was building that up and building a presence within the media world from an organic level. So it was at times daunting. It was like, hey, am I out over my skis? Am I doing too much? But it helped me learn that you can do a lot. I don't give myself credit for, you probably don't give yourself credit for, how much we can physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually do at any point in time. And that's what really taught me from that 18 to 21 year old range.
How did you deal with the nervousness of the job in connection to, and please explain your, I don't know if it's a struggle or just ordeal, but you had to deal with what is known as Palmer hyperhidrosis.
So Palmer hyperhidrosis it basically equates to extremely sweaty hands and feet. 1% of the population has it, so it's extremely rare. And in our culture, obviously, like, you shake a person with sweaty hands, and you instantly click on saying, like, this person's nervous, this guy's got anxiety, he's not confident about himself, and you already kind of remove yourself from that conversation, because that's the first thing you do. And I had that growing up ever since I can imagine. Like, 5 years old was when I remember, oh, gosh, I got really sweaty hands. Like, I don't know what this means, and I'm not nervous. I'm not, I don't have the stress. But it creates really awkward moments, and it creates moments that, like, you almost, as I big picture, I always felt I was in a prison. And being at ESPN or even, you know, the media world or any corporate structure, like, the first thing you do is a firm handshake and look them in the eye, and that's how your introduction is. And my first handshake was, okay, I'm about to come up to you, and I know that we're about to shake hands, was put my hand in my pocket, try to drench as much sweat as I can in the pocket and pull it out really quickly and pray that there's very little sweat in my hand at that time.
Wow.
So that went on high school, middle school, college, up until my sophomore year, where I tried everything under the sun. your oral topicals, your gels, your shock therapy, your pills, and every time there's hope. I mean, it was like, hey, the dermatologist said there's this new field to take on and possibly cure you. So I'm all in. I try it, it doesn't work. It doesn't work quickly. And growing up in a Catholic family, where obviously you're holding hands, our Father, you're shaking hands, he'll bless you. Man, it was tough. It was really tough. It kind of creates this picture in my mind of why I did things the way I did leading up to being 21 years old and why I do things now. Is I'm so appreciative that my parents had the ability to, one, research and understand and ask the right questions, and then, two, pay for a surgery for this, where it's a minimally invasive surgery. They go through, make two little incisions underneath my armpits, and they take a little instrument, and they go through, and you have a couple nerves in your back that control your sweat glands to your hands and your feet, and they snip them. And they take it, they actually remove the nerve from your back. And wow. Instantly, it's like a faucet, turns off, no sweat. So I went to bed in Hogue Hospital, or anesthesia, like I'm looking at my parents, and I've got sweaty hands. Like, they just sweat. There's no rhyme, but like some people, because you're nervous, you start sweating. And that's just the reaction. That's the stimulus. I just sweat because I just sweat.
Right.
So I couldn't control it. Like, talk about controlling the controllables. There was no control in this. So, I look at my parents, and this is where Mort and I, we have an inside joke, and Trent too, that my last lines were legitimately like, it's been a good run. I mean, and my mom nearly fainted. She goes, you can't say that. I go, hey, you know what? It really has been a good run. So I wake up and I feel my hands and they're dry. And I go, there's no way this is happening. This is a dream. And all the classes, like when I was writing essays in class, like the in-class essays, quite possibly the biggest nightmare ever, because my paper would come out drenched in sweat. So imagine trying to write, three sentences in a row that you're just flowing on thought, but like each sentence you have to pick it up, you have to like wipe your hand, and then you got to write again. SATs, ACTs, all that stuff. So I was so conscientious of what people were thinking and looked at me. When really big picture, they probably were like, oh, whatever. It is what it is. So within that, eczema kind of runs in my family. So my hands would create like sores and like cuts and stuff. So not only did they sweat, they looked gross. Like they weren't appetizing to even like try to shake my hand. So obviously I kind of hide away from any social interaction, wear gloves when I can in sports. But sitting on that table and doctor says you're good to go, it was a huge turning point in my life that I'm, again, deeply appreciative that not everyone has that ability to get that surgery. And there's a lot of people suffering because they don't have the finances, they don't have the people to talk to, the research to get that surgery done, and it's debilitating. I mean, I don't think I would be where I'm at if I had sweaty palms still, to be real, because the environments you're put in is where I'm at. Always rely on a handshake, always rely on personability and having confidence and having this presence about you that I was shying away from leading up to 21 years old, spring break, my sophomore year in college.
Yeah, I'm interested in that because, to remind people here, you just came through the NFL draft a couple weeks ago by the time this podcast comes out. And your job at ESPN and in the draft is to be around every face that we watch, from Todd McShay to Berman, Dilford, yada, 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 but also the prospects when they come out and they're getting interviewed on set. Also within the Elite 11, if you're not familiar with that, I think American Idol for high school quarterbacks, the best quarterback competition in the country. And we go from region to region, find the top 20-some quarterbacks, bring them to Los Angeles for a competition to find the top 11 quarterbacks in the country. And you're around a lot of high performers who are perceived as almost like political figures, right? They're perfect. They say the right thing. They've got these big expectations. They're on their way to make millions or potentially will once they go through college because they're all committed to these major universities and institutions that we adore and laud over. So in your evaluation, I'm just kind of flashing back to the war room of the documentaries, which will be linked in on this blog post. You've always had a unique perspective on athletes. Quarterback specifically. Part of it, and we both relate in this, we didn't play the position in college or in the NFL, but what along your path, obviously palmar hyperhidrosis, being undersized and an overachiever, but how have you really seen it influence how you evaluate? You know, like, do you have like another category of called like being human, you know, versus body strength, speed, arm strength?
No, I mean, the foundation, I've been so blessed and gifted in the sense that, you know, if you trace it all the way back, and I talked about Coach Johnson, Coach Bob Johnson, and he almost, you know, you can correct me, he almost created the quarterback guru space. He was one of the first guys to have pre-draft guys work out for him. He had seen so much football as a coach. He played the position. And on top of that, he had a son who performed at the highest level, Rob Johnson, in the NFL, and another son, Brett, CFL, played a little bit in NFL. So he's a pioneer in the space. And he's in my backyard. I'm playing for the guy. And I remember Elite 11 11 years ago when I'm a sophomore in high school, and it's July, and he goes, "Hey, Roberts," and he calls a couple other sophomore receivers. He goes, "I need you to be at San Juan, I think it's San Juan Hills or something, that community sports park, and it's for the Elite 11. And that was my first introduction to Elite 11. And I roll out there, and I remember just seeing Jason White. I go, "Jason White, this guy just won the Heisman. And he's here throwing balls to me. How cool is this?" So you got Bob Johnson, just by default, being in those rooms, watching film with them, of our own film, Mission Viejo, and then being around the pre-draft guys, and seeing the higher level learning that they put them through, that was a great foundation for me. I always came back during spring break to catch balls. I always came back during the summer to help with camps because I just wanted to be around it. I want to soak it up. It goes back to me at 18 realizing, like, I got to learn this game. And one of my best resources is 5 minutes away from my house. So lean into Bob Johnson, lean into his expertise. Within that, the next guy up on my list of being so blessed that he's in my life is Trent Dilfer. We both say it to a man, and being around enough quote-unquote experts and analysts in this space on TV and in the coaching community, there may not be one person who studies position more than Trent Dilfer. And as you pointed out and I pointed out and he's pointed out on Elite 11 documentaries, is – it haunts him going to bed that he didn't reach his maximum potential. And why didn't he reach his maximum potential? And is it a flawed stroke, or is it a flawed off the field? Is it anything? Why didn't he reach his maximum potential? So he just spends hours upon hours upon days trying to learn the intricacies of being a quarterback. And he luckily just my sophomore year when he joined on ESPN, he saw us doing work with Mort, and I'm sitting next to him in the war room. In the war room, if you can picture it for anyone out there, that you got 10 flat screen TVs on a Sunday, and they're all playing NFL games. It's like football heaven, you know, on a minor scale. You got locker room talk with all the analysts, and I noticed Trent's taking a lot of notes and possible to see everything. So I like nudge him and say, like, "Hey, Drew Brees is doing this," and nudge him again, Peyton Manning's doing this. Again, like what I told you with Mort, like, my notes initially were horrible. My observations, Trent, horrible. But he's like, okay, this guy's persistent, and he has a thirst for learning. And he called me up my winter break in my sophomore year and said, "Hey, I want to share you with Mort." And I go, "Sure. Like, what does that mean?" He goes, "You'll do Sunday countdown with Mort in the morning. You'll do afternoons with us in the war room, and then you'll do nights with me on the Sports Center." So that's 8 in the morning till midnight-ish day. Like, absolutely, let's do it. And then he put me on some quarterback projects to kind of widen my lens on what exists at the NFL and college level. And then on top of that, it's just purely understanding stroke mechanics and why do certain quarterbacks succeed and other quarterbacks don't succeed. So Trent Dilfer is a huge part in that as a thought leader in the space, and then being with him is you start at revolutionizing what is being talked about and how it's being talked about and how it's being taught to the kids. And then it just splinters off from there from thought leaders like George Whitfield and Jordan Palmer and you and the quarterback coaches in the NFL, quarterback coaches at the college level, because it's the most important position in all sports. It's the most influential position in all sports. And it's got a big question mark by it. You know, everyone says it's an inexact science. And I agree with that to a point, but there are commonalities with all the great quarterbacks that you can start checking the boxes off on that there will have to be an exception to the rule, but the rule could exist for a broad spectrum of quarterbacks that we can predict that he will not be a bust or he will be semi-successful. Now, you can never take a situation like Tom Brady and use that as a rule, but you can take the middle ground and say, all right, can we evaluate this kid at 18 and try to project him to college and then project him to the NFL? So all those names and influences on my life kind of, and then on top of that, just my own feel and intuition for it, boil down to how I evaluate a quarterback and what perspective I bring as a non-quarterback, as a guy that you would never expect to talk about quarterbacks. And there's just a natural curiosity that I have about the position. It's fascinating. It's fascinating that these guys have so much influence and they have no clue they have. That if Jared Goff does something, a million people will now do it just because Jared Goff did it. Russell Wilson's reach is tremendous. And if he does or says anything, little kid, 6, 7, 8-year-old, will do it in a heartbeat, not even look twice. At the end of the day, that's what it is. And I'm just really blessed that Bob and Coach Johnson and Trent and you and George and Andy Bark and Brian Stepp, all those guys exist in my ecosystem.
Yeah, well, no doubt. And where I want to pivot to, Joey, is that, you know, you just went on this amazing, you know, this great statement about all the people that have influenced you, right? And you have no problem diving in to other people's stories, right? If you follow the quarterback space, Joey, you probably have 5 years, every quarterback who's, you know, a top 300, probably the top 300 to 500 quarterbacks in the country in high school, you've got a document with an evaluation on them. You've got an evaluation of every starter in, you know, major Power Five schools or anyone who's had success at that position, a variety of guys that go to the NFL. I mean, this is your life, right? You've got the packets, you've got the attachments, you've got the Excel spreadsheets, you got everything. Ultimately, you spend your day, whether that's 6 a.m. to midnight, on other people's stories. Fox, as we are friends, you've told me that you started to work on yours. What is that shift like? Has it been hard? And what have you found out as you've pivoted?
It's kind of crazy to know the stories of, you know, 100 or so quarterbacks really well and where they're going, and whether it's a Christian Hackenberger or Jared Goff or even a Shane Buechel, who's arguably Texas's next best quarterback. But personally, it's exciting. It's exciting to really dive into what makes me tick and how I'm passionate about things I'm passionate about. And when this podcast airs, I'm guessing it's going to air afterwards, but, you know, I'm fired up that I booked a trip to Europe. And I'm going to join you in Paris, and there's no itinerary that we might go to Croatia, we might go to Barcelona. That understanding that there's a culture and there's cultures outside of this small football community that is the ESPN world that I live in, the Elite 11 world that I live in, or the Mission Viejo world or stuff like that, that it's going to broaden my horizons, I think, 10x, and I'm going to come back with a worldly point of view. And that's going to make, I think, it's going to make me better as an evaluator, because it'll make me more compassionate to some stories that maybe I wasn't compassionate beforehand, that I'm going to see it through a different lens. that my view of trustworthiness, which is, I think, the one word that every quarterback evaluation should boil down to, will be broadened a little bit, or it'll be honed in more. And if you can hone it in more, then you're going to have a better evaluation process, and you're probably going to have better results on who ends up playing well and who ends up doesn't play well. And then if those who don't play well or have been put up on a pedestal as 4- or 5-star kids that maybe should be a 2- or 3-star kid, how are you going to be compassionate to guide them through life when football is taken away from them? The only thing that they've really had, and they've been the dude in their community, they've been given everything. Like, how am I going to be a connector in that way, shape, or form? Make them better.
How hard is it, though? I mean, there's a lot of people listening now that are in their late 20s, 30s, maybe even older, that are competing in their job, right? And you're hyper-focused at selling sponsorship on an event, or you're hyper-focused on your real estate project, or you're hyper-focused at ESPN. I mean, how hard is it for you to begin the path towards, you know, mastery around you? Because your life is dedicated, at least from my perspective, your life is dedicated to learning about other people and putting them on a platform to succeed. But as you know, they're never going to be at their best. The people that you help, the people that you nudge, the people that you try to impact, unless you're at your best. And it seems like you're going down this road of self-exploration. So I want to know how hard it is. Because even in that response, you revert back to football. You know, so
yeah.
You know, it's clearly a process for you, and I'm curious if it's difficult, because I think people listening are on that same process, and they're driving to work right now saying, damn, man, like I want to live for me right now, and I'm living for the man, even though the man is the coolest can be, and for you and you, it's Elite 11 and ESPN, but ultimately you've got to live Joey Roberts' path, right? So how hard is that?
Yeah, extremely difficult. And that's funny, I didn't even subconsciously know I reverted back to football in some way, shape, or form. It's challenging. And I think it's where looking and forecasting it out, as every day you start uncovering a little bit of wisdom about my own self, is leaning in on guys like you, leaning in on Trent's and Chris Mortensen's of the world, that it's not about football, it's about life. Leaning in on my brother and sister, my mom and dad, and my grandparents, that through their identity and their philosophy of life, that it could kind of uncover some things that I didn't know existed in myself. And I think the podcast between yours and Dr. Michael Gervais have already uncovered a lot of things that made me curious about, oh, what do I think about that? Philosophically, like, how would I have handled that adversity that you talked about with Kevin Carroll, and it's fascinating. And I agree that I will never be able to help a quarterback reach his maximum potential if I am not reaching my maximum potential.
Right. So let's talk about somebody who I've watched change your life. You talked about the football stuff, and your first day on the job with Chris Mortensen. And again, we'll have a picture on the blog on this, but you know, for those that don't know Chris Mortensen, arguably the best NFL reporter in the history of the game. He's a guy who's been on TV for decades, but you haven't seen him on recently because he's battling cancer. And Joey, this guy has impacted your life so much that you shaved your head because he's going through chemotherapy. Curious on your path that you just described about figuring you out, where his story has impacted you.
Yeah, it's a big one. You kind of realize it's just hair. I mean, it'll grow back. It's already grown back. Biggest fear a lot of people have is losing their hair. And he didn't have his hair down there in Houston when I visited him. But the ultimate road to self-discovery right now, these past 3 months, and as he's battling through chemo and radiation, he's in every thought. Whether he knows it or not, everything reverts back to, okay, so I'm having a semi-bad day. The meeting didn't go well. I didn't get this evaluation done in time, or the delayed flight out of Charlotte, or whatever it is. Not that bad. Broad scheme of things, it's really nothing, actually. And it's a resiliency. It's everything that he's demonstrating down there in Houston that puts everything into perspective. And, you know, I share this with you, Yogs, is that, like, you know, this is the ninth draft that I did. Previous eight with Mort, and previous eight, we have a just tradition. The night before the draft, we go into his room, and we bunker down, and we go through all the notes, and I tell you, between Chris Mortensen and Adam Schefter, they have binders full of NFL draft notes that could probably carry a network if they were just to talk for a couple months. I mean, they work their butts off, and they have connections that no one could ever imagine. And we go sift through them, and how would this apply to this team, and how would this apply to that player? If this team trades up, what would happen? Make phone calls, you know, eat some food, wrap up around 2 o'clock in the morning, get a quick shut-eye, come back in the morning, continue to write out some note cards, and just be ready. The NFL draft's the biggest reality TV show. You don't know what's going to happen. You can try to predict it as much as you can, but you got to over-prepare. And that's where I learn about preparation is through Mort, among other people. But this draft was different. It was in Chicago, and Mort wasn't there. And it was, you know, you can't really describe it other than just pure emotional tears. And I told you this, and I'm really happy that I told you this, that, like, I knew this was going to happen, that the night before the draft would come, and I would just be emotionally overcome with every feeling in the world, sadness, joy, whatever it is, and it ultimately equated to tears. And he said, look, a cool exercise to do, because you'll never be able to recreate that feeling, is to write a letter to yourself, or send yourself a voicemail, or just do anything to capture that moment. So I go to the Nike event, get to say hi to Jared Goff and Carson Wentz, take a picture of them, send it to Mort, send it to Trent. And I'm in the room, make a couple calls, write down some notes, about midnight. And then the waterworks just start happening. You start crying. And you just realize that he's not here. He's alive and he's well and he's battling. But the event that he loves the most, in his 25th year, he's not going to be here. And you can't really do anything about it other than just emotionally wrap your brain around it and then move on. So I did a little voicemail to myself. It was 4 minutes, and it's something that I'll cherish forever, just explaining my emotions for Mort and how much he has helped me pursue something that I'm so passionate about. And it dawned on me, you know, you take a picture with the first and second overall pick in the draft and really not think anything of it, because they're just, I saw Jared when he was 170 pounds soaking wet and saw his journey through Cal, and he just happened to be the first overall pick. Carson Wentz comes out, and as a North Dakota State kid, as a counselor among the likes of Cody Kessler at USC, JT Barrett at Ohio State, and he absolutely gives so much back to the kids as a great perspective of he was under-recruited, he was not even recruited, and now he's here. And he just happens to be the second overall pick. And I say, wow, you take a step back, and what if Mort didn't say yes? I just said, but, you know, Bob, I really don't do this, which he doesn't. I don't know the kid. I'm not going to, you know, I have too much on my plate. Or if that call doesn't go through, what if Bob doesn't make that call? And all those emotions start going through your brain, and you're like, gosh. And I'm at a place, the NFL draft, where that's the center of the football world and something that I've been thirsting and driving for. And it all boils down to, like, the what if. What if the answer was no? And luckily, the answer had been yes. And that's when the emotions were tearful and went to bed just, you know, crying. But woke up, rejuvenated, talked to Mort that morning, told him I was thinking about him, told him that I do think about if he did say no, or if he said no my sophomore year and junior year. And as I said earlier in the podcast, he just said, I had patience with you because a lot of people in my life had patience with me. And all it is really paying it forward. So, and the long story short, that's what Mort, the most recent Mort story I have.
Wow. How connected are you to emotions, and is it much more than you've been in your life right now?
By far much more. Kind of what's going on. It's been a roller coaster because it seems like all the big connecting points in my life are dealing with adversity in some way, shape, or form, more so than I've ever been aware of, or maybe I just haven't took the time to be aware of. Everyone just goes through adversity by default. So if my whole goal is to help others reach the maximum potential and be a connector, then it's been absolutely, it took more to get diagnosed with cancer to really lean in on this awareness level that I've never had. And then how can I understand what's happening and then have some type of execution plan to help it? That's visiting him down in Houston, or if that's helping out others in my life that are dealing with pain and suffering, how can I help? What's the action plan? And it has been emotionally, I can say, draining sometimes, but also it brings up moments of joy because there's a vulnerability factor there that you can't replicate. You can't just read it in the book and say, that's what I'm going to feel at that moment. Because it just happens naturally.
You know, it's interesting, you know, when I talk to people that have been around you that don't really know our relationship and we've known each other for a long time, whether it's Teddy or other guys that you've worked with in the league, everybody kind of refers to you as a rock star, you know, as a prodigy almost. And, you know, you're a guy who you got 4 years in the workspace while you were in undergrad. You know, usually, you know, think about it now, you'd be 4 years out of college right now where you're at, but really you're kind of an 8-year veteran. Like you said, it was your ninth draft. How do you deal with that of knowing the trajectory that you're on?
I don't really think about it, to be honest. Live day to day, live in the moment. I think it's extremely, you mentioned Teddy Bruschi, and we had dinner the night before the draft, just me and him, and hear him talk about his kids, and there's such a thirst for what the world will be for me that I know I will be a husband. I know I'll be a father. I know that I'll be in some leadership position. I'll be in the football world. I mean, these are all question marks, kind of, but I know that they're eventually going to happen. To hear him talk about his sons, hearing Trent talk about his daughters, hearing Mort talk about his son, hearing their passion that comes through their voice, and you can legitimately just feel it, that's the day-to-day stuff. That's what gets me to not think about, all right, well, man, am I on this trajectory to become this director of this college program or work my way up in an NFL team or stay within the ESPN ranks and move up? It doesn't even dawn on me, to be real. My office is literally, I call it an office, but it's a chair and a desk and a computer. It's right behind Adam Schefter on air. So you actually see my head every Sunday countdown. And to get to the studio, you have to go through my chair, technically. So Bill Polian and Mark Dominic and Phil Savage, Jim Trotter, Adam Kaplan, Ed Werder, all the guys have to go through there. And we have great conversations. Some last 1 minute, some last 10, some last 20. If Teddy's literally drawing up the Patriots defense in 2001 and all the dudes that were with him and how they're going to scheme against the Carolina Panthers, I mean, it's limitless. And it's a thirst for knowledge that these guys are able to show, kind of shed a light on what could be. What Bill Polian is an NFL Hall of Famer. And he's arguably one of the best GMs to ever walk the planet. And at any point during the day, if I asked him, you know, how would you construct a roster like this? What would you do here with this injured player? And he gives the 100% genuine answer on how he would do it. I've never been a GM, and maybe one day I am a GM, but now in my mind, I kind of have an understanding on the situational basis of what it is to be a GM at the highest level for Bill Polian. Or just a GM in general, which is extremely hard to do. I mean, the amount of work that they put in to be the Bucs GM if you're Mark Dominic, or the Browns GM if you're Bill Savage. And having them literally just be open to talking about it and talking about things that I can kind of create in my mind and say, all right, if I go down that road, this is what these mentors have said about that. And how am I going to take that information, mix it with my own feelings, and then ultimately make a decision that will have a ripple effect on the organization, the NFL, or the college ranks, or whatever.
That's really cool. All right, so we're gonna pivot here, and you've listened to a bunch of these podcasts, and at the end, I'd like to ask you a phrase or a word, and let me know what your thoughts are around that. So whatever the first thing that comes to mind, knock it out. Number one, capacity.
Being able to do a lot and not be overwhelmed.
Right. It seems like you've mastered that. Like, is that, I mean, do you get overwhelmed? I mean, we all get overwhelmed, right? Like, how do you deal with that? I mean, I couldn't imagine working every day from 6 a.m. to midnight and all about everybody else.
I got some gray hairs at 27. it's just knowing that you got to continue growing. You got to have a thirst for it. And everything that I allow myself to dive into, it's something I'm passionate about. I'm not just going to dive into everything and say, hey, I'm doing a lot. I'm doing a lot. I'm expanding my capacity because I'm not interested in that stuff. So everything that does occupy my time and my energy and the space in my mind has a reason. And it's all synergetic to where I want to go and what I want to be and who I want to associate with.
What makes you, Joey Roberts, feel the most alive?
When I get a thank you. When I get a thank you, whether it's a handwritten thank you, an email, a text message, a call, of a person I've helped out. That's neurologically, physically, emotionally, spiritually, when I feel most alive.
Do you feel as though right now you own your story?
Well, now that this is airing to the public, absolutely. it was inside and I knew it and not many people knew it. And I think, like you talked about it, if I really want to reach my maximum potential to help others reach their maximum potential, it starts with just owning the story. And for the most part, the story's been told. And I hope it's an inspiration to others, and especially those with palmar hyperhidrosis that probably wiping their hands on their jeans or have a towel in their pocket like I did and nervous about what the next interaction is, and just know that you will get through it. And to know, have an awareness of what's out there, whether it's surgical or orally or through pills or whatever it is that you can definitely get through it.
In your eyes, Joey, what is a full life?
A full life, you know, I'll mention a guy that I knew, his name's Connor Gregory. 2 years ago, 25 years old, law student in Seattle University. He's my fraternity brother. At Trinity College, he passed away in his sleep. He had a hole in his heart, went to bed Thanksgiving night, did not wake up the day after Thanksgiving, Friday morning. When I went to his funeral 2 days after and got to see some Trinity people, Trinity College, a couple brothers, a couple girls, a couple friends, and I looked at where we're sitting in the chapel, and we had probably 15 people, and I looked around the chapel, and there was hundreds of people from all walks of life. I mean, you had professors, you had coaches, you had janitors, you had secretaries, everyone. I mean, it's fascinating. So I took away from that, like, Connor lived an absolutely full life. He was so versatile in how he was able to talk sports with me, able to talk law with his buddy down the hall. Then he was able to pivot, talk about literature with his other buddy, and then come full circle and integrate all three conversations into one. He was extremely gifted. And I looked at it and said, whenever I pass away, that I hope that the chapel that I have my funeral at, that there will be people from all walks of life that have a story about me that affected them in a positive way, and that's the reason why they showed up that day to pay homage.
Wow. You know, we talked about this idea of a flame, and I believe that all of us have one, right? It's either charging like a campfire and you're leaning into it, you're warming your hands up, or it's low and you need a new log, you need to kick it over. If you use that analogy, Joey, how would you describe your flame and where is it right now?
I think it's burning very bright. I kind of refer back to, it's either you or Dr. Gervais, or maybe both collaboratively, but leadership is when a person's flame is so bright that people are attracted to it. That's the way I think you or Dr. Gervais described it, but that always stuck with me, and your analogy about the flame always stuck with me, and to the point that I literally think of it in my brain as, okay, the flame's getting a little low, you got to toke the fire. You gotta find something that's gonna stimulate you. You gotta get some positive thoughts going, especially at a time when your emotional roller coaster is going all over the place. So I would at this time say my fire is burning very bright, and I'm welcome to helping others try to get their fire to burn brighter, and ultimately try to reach goals and move the ball forward, football analogy wise, and across the goal line.
That's awesome. And then finally, Joey, when you hear the word limits, what do you think of?
Now, again, once this podcast airs, I will have a whole new definition on limits. Seeing the cultures of Paris and Croatia and Barcelona and feeling the culture, not just being a part of it, that I think limits, we put limits on ourselves. Because there's fear, there's fear of failure, there's fear of being exposed and vulnerable. And to your slogan, Life Without Limits, I'm very excited that going to another country, another universe in my perspective, because I've never been overseas, that's breaking down a limit. That's breaking down a boundary that currently exists in my brain and won't exist within the next 2 weeks. And I think if you continue to push those limits and knock down boundaries, then holistically you'll be more equipped to help others break down their limits and boundaries, and we'll ultimately have a better world.
I love it. All right, so on this podcast, we're going to commit, okay? We're going to do part two after your trip overseas, and we're going to get the recap of how it impacted you and your story, man. And I'm jacked about this because I think a lot of people relate to it. You know, you're in the most competitive industry in media, at the most competitive place, one might argue. And your story, I think, can sometimes get lost amid everybody else's story that you're trying to share, celebrate, elevate, discuss, etc. And you're on the path to making sure that you don't forget yours, man. And I think that's badass, bro. I really do. And I know our listeners are going to appreciate you coming on. So thank you very much.
Thanks, yo. Love being a part of it.
Awesome. All right, man. Well, you and I'm sure we'll talk soon. Thanks for hopping on, and we're going to close off this podcast. And as always, I think when we finish up this podcast, I like to kind of give my little recap, and I take notes throughout the entire conversation. It's really rad. I'll put a picture of it on the post as well. And I want to, because I didn't explain this about Joey, but the first time I met him, he was with Trent, and it was at the Elite 11. And I remember him as a wide out kind of working at the Elite 11 camps when I was, because I'm a little older than Joey when I was first starting along that process, when he was still in high school and then in college. But I remember meeting him, and, you knew he was a Trent, and, you didn't know what his role was. But what I admired so much about Joey is that he was always an active listener. And I relate that to my time at SC. I was an assistant coach there for 4 years under Coach Carroll. And I really got to learn from him from a philosophical standpoint, football from Lane Kiffin and Steve Sarkisian. And I just listened. I just absorbed. And then when I left SC and finished my coaching career, I began to speak. And I began to utilize my voice. And I at times would be like, wow, I didn't know I knew these things. And for Joey, I think it's awesome as he's making this pivot in his life and even this podcast, you know, finally getting his story out there to a degree of he's absorbed so much intel. I mean, just imagine yourself at 18 being around the room he described, Chris Mortensen, Chris Berman, Keyshawn Johnson, Mike Ditka, yada, 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 Dilfer, the whole crew. He's got knowledge in him that we're going to be hearing about for decades. I'm going to try to pull out of him a bunch. And I think that's something to really remember about how important it is to not necessarily always speak, but the importance of listening and actively listening. And the greatest leaders I've ever been around, that's their greatest skill set. So I think the challenge that I'll leave you with, as I always try to on this Life Without Limits podcast, is like Joey did that night before the draft when he thought about the guy who gave him a chance and was his biggest encourager, Chris Mortensen, when he wasn't there and battling, trying to kick cancer's ass, he wrote himself a letter. He did it on a voice note. You can do it on the notes page on your phone. You could do it on your blog. You can do it on your journal for nobody to see, but he shared it. And I would challenge everybody out there to write that, state that, capture that moment about what you're feeling, what you're thinking at any point in time. It could be at a stoplight when you're listening to this podcast. It could be later tonight, whatever it is. But where do you want to go? What's your story? And is it being told authentically through your voice? Because we've all spent a lifetime of listening and learning. And I believe that it's important for us to share our story because we all have one, not one more important than the other. So thank you all. As always, send us a note, send us a review if you can. But most importantly, remember that the only limits in life are the ones we set ourselves. Lots of love. Peace.